Hello and welcome to 10x9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Dorn, and this is the first 10x9 podcast of 2025. With all the festivities and holidays just a distant memory, we were back to the dreariness of January. But we were also back in the black box for our first event of the year. The theme was moving, and we were part of the Out to Lunch Festival here in Belfast. And it was standing room only for 9 amazing true stories. It really was another very special night.
The day of the funeral comes, she has a letter. And on the front, it says, Rachel Smith, to be delivered by hand. She said, I meant to give it to you 10 years ago.
They gave him such a hiding that he lost one tooth, which they later displayed on Facebook. Would he like it back? And the rest had to be wired back into his jaw to save them.
Comrade, do you have any French fries? And the answer was a negative shake of the head. KFC in China served chicken with rice.
So get ready for a moving letter from beyond the grave, a violent threat that forced a family to move from their home, and the hunt for the elusive spud after a move to Beijing. But first, just before we start, on the night, I had to make the audience aware of something. There's a mad photographer running around, and some of you may have seen him, called Ian. So if he takes a photograph, you'll know it's for the Ulster Tattler, and it's all part of the film. I know! Because we are such an Ulster Tattler demographic. Anyway, you'll probably not see it for about 4 years when you're next to the dentist, so you know how it works. Oh, what an honour to be pictured in the Ulster Tattler with the rich and the beautiful. It seems only right. Anyway, on with the stories. And first up, here's Rachel Smith.
I often share with friends to this day how Mike, a man I knew, would send me text when he came home from holiday. They would say things like, all is well, Rachel, had a great time, not dead yet. I would sort of roll my eyes and laugh and reply, well, that's good then, isn't it? This went on for so many years, so much so that I thought he would last forever. We wrote a book together as part of a project I designed and run called Writing for the Future, about his life. We sat for hours and talked about life and death and what his dreams were for his children. We laughed a lot. He had strong opinions. Although my job was to record his thoughts, I simply refused to write down some of the things he said. And he said it was his book and it was his choice, but he accepted my opinion after some discussion. He knew he was dying and faced it with a sort of pragmatism. He wanted to squeeze life into all the little moments he could. He would text me from his caravan and say he was enjoying life in the sun and a gin and tonic, and he hoped I was too. He would text from the chemo unit with chat and thoughts and wondering if I was doing okay and how everyone was so kind and supportive. He was also always so grateful, even though he was dying. We would sit in the living room, his living room, overlooking his garden, and he would talk with gratitude for the life he had. We would talk of the hedges and how they needed cutting. We would talk about how life would be when he was dead and how he wished he could change the end to spare others pain. He asked me to take him to Dignitas, and we both knew that I couldn't. I knew I would miss him. I knew that I would miss the texts from holidays and the comical check-ins. I knew in some ways that I had no right to miss him, as it's just a job. We race through life at such a pace that rarely do we get time to sit and think about connection. And really, what would we do if we were running out of time? I think about this. I'd want to be in a happy, beautiful place surrounded by love. And it makes me realise so acutely that things mean nothing, but time is a commodity that we cannot buy. Mike and I would have talked about that, the fragility of time. I work with the dying and the living who are feeling the pain about the people who have died or are dying. I skirt the edges as the pain is not mine to be felt. And mostly, in all honesty, I don't feel the pain in my heart. I watch the pain and I feel a deep sadness for others. But when Mike died, I cried. I missed our connection and realised he'd created a connection that had drawn me in, and that was such a skill. And I realised I was okay with that, and it made me human, and I was deeply moved. Moved from a place of onlooker to a place of care and sorrow. And it was nice to know that I still felt that. I got a call after he died that he'd left lots of instructions in a box. He'd locked the box with the code inside, and did I by any chance know the code? I didn't. I apologised. They had to smash the box. So very Mike, I thought, and laughed, and how he would have thought it was so funny. His funeral was on a Thursday at midday, and I couldn't go, and I felt sad about that for a very long time. I wanted to go for me. To say thank you, Mike, for pulling me in and having really wonderful conversations and reminding me that all we have is right now. And that wonder in the world that we have when we can see that time will run out. Years passed, 10 to be exact, and I still think of him, but something magical happened. I was in work to meet a family about a funeral just last week. I walk into the room and someone says, "Rachel, it's you." And I feel, yes, it is me, but I draw a complete blank. She says, "I'm Mike's stepdaughter." And for a moment, my breath is taken away and I knew straight away which Mike we were talking about. I'm there to conduct the funeral of her father, as I'm now a funeral celebrant. We put aside the conversation as it's not for now, and we talk about her dad and how he put honeysuckle in her bedroom at night and made her jasmine tea. The day of the funeral comes, and she comes to me. She has a letter, sort of crumpled at the edges, and on the front it says, "Rachel Smith, to be delivered by hand." It was from Mike. She said, "I meant to give it to you 10 years ago. It was to be given to you after he died." I tuck it in my folder, as I can't read it before reading about her dad. I want to be present in the moment there for her dad. But I know it's there. Like, he is there. His words are there, tucked in my folder as they are right now. Fresh, unread words written by Mike to me. Someone who inspired me so much in how they faced dying and how they lived, and also how he made sure he remained in my thoughts. The music of the funeral seems more poignant than normal, and everyone seems rather vivid. I watch the daughter's son playing with a Paw Patrol truck, and he is smiling at me, and I think about the letter and that 10 years ago, this wonderful little human was not there. I do find when someone has died that the world comes into sharp focus. Rain seems intently beautiful and colours seem bright. Sounds seem louder and love seems huge. The service ends and I find a quiet place in the funeral directors to read when everyone is gone. There is some drama, as we know, that I have a letter from 10 years ago and someone suggests I read it alone so that I can have a cry. And then, on 3 handwritten pages, are his words to me about how I had changed the last chapter of his life and how my words had brought him to share with his son that he was dying and that he was so grateful. It felt like treasure. It felt like that was the day that I was meant to receive the letter. It told me he hoped I would lead a long life and I deserved all the happiness for all I did for others. And at the end, it said, "Best wishes, Mike," and a kiss. But it also said, "I know you will be there for my son or daughter if they ever need you." I later say to the daughter at the crematorium, we are about to do the committal for her father, and she said, "Well, that's the strangest thing, because today you've looked after me when I needed it the most." Mike died in September 2014. In January 2025, a letter arrives from Mike. Time has moved forward. He would be a grander now. He would have seen his daughter married and his son living in Australia. If he had never been ill, I never would have met him. Or would I? Those words in the letter remind me about the impact we have on each other without realizing. Who knows how or why I was there for his daughter? We embraced in true connection, knowing that Mike would have smiled and we shed tears. Showing how moments of gratitude can have ripples through the life we lead in the years to come. So a kind word, or maybe a text when you come home from a holiday, just to remind someone you're not dead. Because really what you're saying is, hello, how are you? I think about you. I care. So Mike, I remember you. I'm just back from holiday. I had an amazing time in Berlin. All is well, and I'm not dead.
Rachel, thank you so much for that. What a series of connections you can only get from real life. And you really brought Mike to life. Thank you. And Rachel told me she sent me the story literally hours after she got that letter. As I'm always reminding you, 10x9 is constantly looking for storytellers, whether it's your first time or, like Rachel, you're back for another go. So get in touch via the website, 10x9.com. It doesn't matter if it's just a vague idea or a fully formed epic. And if you're a bit nervous, shy, and reluctant, I'll do my best to make it as easy a process as possible. Okay, on to our next story. And she's been supporting 10x9 since our earliest days. It's always great to have her tell her story. Here's Laurie Randall. Just to explain, in case you're overseas, the UDA is a paramilitary group.
In January 2016, I got a phone call from my wee sister. It was a Saturday morning, and my stomach was in free fall as I answered my mobile. Before Christmas, there had been some trouble. Her youngest son got in a row about a girl with five lads he had known since primary school. The police intervened, broke the fight up, and sent him home from the house party on his own. He walked the direct route. The others left by car, intercepting him as he came through the pedestrian gate between the estates. They gave him such a hiding that he lost one tooth, which they later displayed on Facebook. Would he like it back? And the rest had to be wired back into his jaw to save them. He woke his mum, and she got an ambulance for him, but not before she had gone round to the house of one of the other fellas and screamed blue murder in the street. These were lads who had run in and out of her house as children and been fed at her table along with her own sons. The police arrived before the ambulance, but not to take a statement from her son. They came to lift her. So instead of accompanying her bloodied son to the hospital, she spent the night in a police cell. The accusations against her were wide-ranging, contradictory, and eventually dropped. A few days before Christmas, the police came to the door again, this time to deliver a death threat to my sister from an unspecified source. She was to leave her home or face the consequences. One of the lads who had jumped her son was UDA. But when she tried checking out the threat with different local loyalist representatives, they said there was nothing to it. The threat was not sanctioned. So she decided to stay. She was not moving. She'd made this flat beautiful, and they could take her out of it in a box. That was December. This was January. This morning, she's ringing to say that she is moving. She got another threat last night and has to be out by 6:30 p.m. today. Her quote, Of course, the bastards waited till after the housing executive shut. Earlier this week, the police had lifted some of those lads for questioning about the attack on her son. So this time the threat is confirmed. She must leave Lisburn. She's ringing to me to see, can I help her get an extension on the deadline? She won't have everything packed and away by 6:30 p.m. They only have a trailer and it takes so long between runs. Could I ring someone senior in the UDA and ask for a few more hours? I can't. How can I ask, will you please give my sister a couple more hours to move out of her house? I can't. I tell her I can't. I want to find another way. Would a van help? Maybe Eric could get hold of one. It's Saturday morning. So Eric is out walking the dogs. I try ringing him, but he doesn't hear his mobile. I look up van sites, so there are some options ready when he finally walks back in with a pair of happy dogs and a bird count to add to his record book. I'm fizzing, but getting nowhere. It turns out that hiring a van in a hurry is not a simple thing on a Saturday. I give up on that. We'll just have to get her packed and out. I arrive at my sister's flat. There's hugs and tears. Her feature wall in the living room used to say, life isn't about waiting for the storm to pass. It's learning to dance in the rain. Now, for anyone glancing through the front window, it says, fuck the UDA. I spend the rest of the morning wrapping glasses and crockery in my old copies of the Church Times and packing the contents of her kitchen cupboards into boxes. I come across the bottle of champagne I got her for Christmas with hopes that she would have something good to celebrate in the new year. Her youngest son is keeping out of the way, so it's just her two older boys and her fella doing the driving. They have had the row a few times. Her boys don't want their mum to move. Bowing down to them lot. But her fella is a long distance lorry driver. He can't bear to leave her here unprotected. She deserves some peace. I have to sort my own family in the afternoon, but at 5 p.m. I head back over to my sister's flat. She has about an hour to go before the deadline. She's never going to be out by then. I ring a friend to check that there would be a possible communication line if things go badly. And pack my hymn book on the front seat with ideas of non-violent defusing. At the flat, we are still packing. Her dogs are looking for cuddles from anyone who will offer them. And her older sons are stacking the trailer for the penultimate run. Now it is after 6:30 p.m. My sister has told them that I will handle anything if someone comes to the door. The boys are keeping the kitchen knives till last in case that doesn't work. A car with tinted windows has been in and out of the cul-de-sac and the local taxi firm has been cruising by, so it must be very clear to them that she is definitely moving out. The guys head off, leaving my sister and I, along with her pregnant daughter-in-law, to gather together the last load. The last bits always take longer than expected. We have run out of boxes again, and everything else is going in bin bags. Eventually we finish and sit waiting in the front room for the fellas to return to load up the last trailer run. My sister is smoking. She never smoked in her living room. Wanted to keep it good. Now she is sitting on a bag of stuff out of the fridge, complaining that her bum was getting cold and flicking ash onto her good wooden floor. The guys get back and fill the trailer with the last load. They take up the kitchen flooring in the hopes that it will do her next place. As the final pieces are gathered, the energy is zinging in the flat. One of her sons takes a hammer to the beautiful wooden floor that runs from the living room through the connecting hall. Every piece is lifted and smashed. My sister says, "Better take a hammer to the floor than take it to someone's head." Then the blinds are pulled down and crushed. And once we have removed every last thing and stowed the dogs in the two cars, the light bulbs bite the dust. It's 8:30 p.m., 2 hours after the deadline, but no one has come round to protest at our tardiness. The neighbours carefully don't look out past their curtains. By agreement, we all leave simultaneously. The boys driving off with the last trailer load and the women with me off to a temporary resting place above the shankle.
Laurie, that was so powerful. Hard to believe these people still operate among us. But what a story. The audience really shared your anger. Now, you know 10 by 9 is always free, but if you'd like to help ensure our events and this podcast continue, you can help us out with a donation via Patreon. There's a link on our website, 10by9.com. As always, a big thank you to everyone who has given over the years, whether electronically or at our live events. It really helps, and we are so grateful. Okay, on to our third and final story on this podcast, and it's from Richard O'Leary. Now, we'd not heard from him for a little while, so the audience was delighted to have him back. I've kept in my introduction from the evening, and just note, the applause starts even before I reveal his name. I think we've created a star.
He is the best thing by far to have come out of Cork. Big warm welcome for Richard O'Leary.
I now live in Bangor for the last 25 years. But long, long ago, in the last century, when I was growing up in County Cork, my father grew vegetables, including my favourite vegetable. And can any of you guess what was my favourite vegetable? No. It was the potato. Broccoli. I mean, do I look like a broccoli person? Jesus. Cabbage. Every year in spring, I'd watch my father pick up a spade and use it to dig the rows. And by midsummer, they'd be ready to harvest. And I'd be let up pick up the spade, a spade as tall as myself, and turn over the dry clay to reveal the first handful of new potatoes. Like this. Now, I don't normally carry a potato in my trouser pocket. This potato is for illustrative purposes only. And my father would recite to me a ditty we had in Cork about a potato. a ditty he'd recite in a broad West Cork accent. Would you like to hear it? Our oo from Cork, I am a oo. Do you hate spuds? I do you. How do you like them? Big and small. How do you hate them? Skins and all. As a young man, I left Ireland in 1987 and headed to the east, the far east, to live in the People's Republic of China. China at that time was a poor communist country. And at my college in Beijing, we had no self-catering facilities. So everybody had to eat in the communal canteen. And breakfast at 8 o'clock in the morning was porridge. Porridge made from rice. And dinner at midday was based on rice. And our evening meal, can you guess what it was? More rice. There was nay a boiled or roast spud to be seen. In my Chinese language class, we were never taught the word in Chinese for potato. So I looked up my Chinese language dictionary, and the word for potato in Chinese is tu do. So I went to the local vegetable market to buy tu do. And I asked the stallholder in Chinese, "Tongzhi, ni you mei you tu do?" Comrade, do you have any potatoes? And the answer was always a negative shake of the head. It appeared that Sir Walter Raleigh, who it is said introduced the potato to Ireland in the 16th century, had never made it to China. But one day in December 1987, my hopes were raised of finding the elusive spud. A branch of Kentucky Fried Chicken, KFC, had just opened in downtown Beijing. Indeed, this was the first ever Western-style fast food outlet to open in Beijing. So that same week, I cycled into the center of Beijing, parked my bike next to Tiananmen Square, and walked into the new KFC. And I asked, "Comrade, do you have any French fries?" And the answer was a negative shake of the head. KFC in China served chicken with rice. In moving to Beijing, I was coming to accept that I'd have to live a life without potatoes. And what an empty life that would be. But I had a plan. Maybe I could find a substitute, a poor substitute, for potatoes. Can any of you think what might be a substitute? Potato crisps. I wasn't expecting to find our own Irish favourite tater crisps. But my roommate told me that the Chinese had started to manufacture in China a Chinese version of the Western potato crisp. So I went into the state grocery store and I asked, "Comrade, do you have any potato crisps?" And the answer was a nod of the head, yes. And I left that store with a packet of potato crisps. This packet of potato crisps. I was so delighted that I kept the packet as a souvenir. And I wrote about this purchase in a letter I wrote at the time to my friend Terry. This letter. June 18th, 1988, Beijing. And it says on the letterhead, China University of Political Science and Law. That was the university where I was teaching English. Dear Terry, I bought some Chinese potato crisps. The packet even has a description in English. The Chinese write English on the packaging of some products to make them look more impressive. And look, you can see I attached to the letter the back of an empty packet of Chinese potato crisps. And I'll read out to you what was written on the back of the packet. explanation of product. This fried slices of potato is the newest convenient food. It is processed through the advanced produce line imported from England. This kind of food has both fruit function and grain effect and consists of vitamin C and vitamin D, E. If you often eat, it can prevent aging. Prevent aging. Well, I did eat many packets of those Chinese crisps, but as you can see, it did not prevent me from aging. Nevertheless, I was grateful for potatoes in any form, and it prompted me to teach my Chinese students the potato ditty I'd heard from my dad. Decades later, they may well be in China, middle-aged graduates of the China University of Political Science and Law, who can still repeat this ditty and in a Cork accent. Are you from Cork? I am. Oh, do you eat spuds? I do. Do you? How do you like them? Big and small. How do you eat them? Skins and all. I moved back to Ireland in July 1988, just in time for the harvesting of the bitter crop in my father's garden. I went and got a spade. I pressed it with my right foot. There was no significance to a right foot in Cork. And pressed it into the dry, clumpy summer clay. I turned over the soil to reveal a scattering of new potatoes. And I lifted up one of those beautiful, cur pink potatoes. And I was a happy lad. I went into the kitchen, put on a pot of water, boiled my potatoes, in their skins, of course. Mmm, delicious. And a good reason for moving back to Ireland.
Ah, Richard, what a way to send us home. I don't know about you, but I need to hear that ditty just one more time.
Are you from Cork? I am a oo. Do you eat spuds? I do. Do you? How do you like them? Big and small. How do you eat them? Skins and all.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for all the laughs. And that's it for this podcast. You can keep up with all our coming and events and themes by having a look at our website, 10by9.com. The dates for 2025 are all there, along with a couple of themes to get you thinking. 10by9 is on the socials, of course. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and or Instagram. And I promise not to flood your feed with nonsense, just information. And I'll try to get to grips with Blue Sky too, I promise. Thanks to everyone who makes 10by9 live events happen, the wonderful Leanne and Margaret, as well as Chris and Cara, the lovely team at the Black Box, by far the best venue in Belfast, the audience, of course, they really make the storytellers and me feel right at home. And of course, thanks to all those storytellers, but the biggest thanks this week goes to Rachel Smith, Laurie Randall and Richard O'Leary. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.